The Vintage Gamer, Episode 16, Origins 2006 Report, with reviews of Turn in Taxis, Buccaneer, Funny Friends, Curse of the Dark Pharaoh, Enemy Chocolatier, and many others.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hi, this is Jim. A bit of a disclaimer here before you listen to the episode. I originally recorded it on Saturday, before the Spiel des Jahres winners were announced. As part of the show, I actually talk about four of the ones that I saw at Origins, so a few of my comments aren't really apropos, but hopefully you enjoy the episode anyway. And as a side note, congratulations to Karen and Andreas Zafarth for winning for Turn in Taxis. Enjoy the show. Welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer is available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. And welcome to the Big Origins Review Podcast. Because I have so many games to cover, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking up front, but I do have a few short items to cover. First of all, I want to thank Paul Tevis again for inviting me to participate in the Gaming Podcasters panel. It was a lot of fun, and it was great to meet all the people there. Maybe next year I'll actually spend some time in the boardroom and meet some more people that way. But, I don't know, I was so busy as it was, it's hard for me to imagine finding more time. I do want to apologize to the one listener I met at Origins. Unfortunately, I didn't catch your name, but I'd been up the night before with Paul and Murr playing Arkham Horror at the Big Bar in 2, and I really wasn't at my best that morning. I'd also lost some of my voice because the bar was rather loud, so I'm afraid I kind of grunted at him while waiting in line to get in the dealer's room. Sorry about that. Hopefully you're still listening. As I've already covered some of what I did in Origins in my Board Game Geek Geek list and my top 10 list on the Dice Tower, thanks again, Tom, I'm going to focus primarily on the games and do a large number of quickie game reviews of just the games I actually played at Origins. And after that, I'll have some final thoughts on the show. As I'm trying to cover a number of games, I won't go into a great deal of detail on the mechanics, just enough to give a sense of the game. Starting with Rio Grande, the big game is the Spiel des Jahres contender Turn in Taxis, designed by Karen and Andreas Zafarth, and originally published by Hans im Glück. As this is the odds-on favorite to win this year, I actually gave it two plays in the dealer hall, and eventually bought it. I think it was a good choice, and it should see a fair amount of play at our table. A lot of people are describing Turn in Taxis as being similar to Ticket to Ride. I believe it's more clearly related to Cardinal and Koenig, or Web of Power as it's known in English. I also see a touch of Elfinland and, well, naturally, Puerto Rico, given the designer. The game is based on the first postal system, I think it might be the first postal system ever, located in Germany, originally founded by the Turn in Taxis families. The goal of the game is to gain points through constructing routes through cities and regions in southern Germany, by picking and playing cards from a set of face-up cards or from a deck of face-down cards. That's the Ticket to Ride part, although that mechanic does exist in Web of Power. Once you have a route established, you can put stations along it, restricted by the regions it crosses. You can either place one house in every region along the route, or in all cities within one region on the route. This is the part that reminds me of Web of Power the most, just the way that you have restrictions by region. You only get to play one station per city, and leftover houses count against you at the end of the game. So, like Elfinland, another object is to construct routes that provide the most efficient coverage of the board. The semi-Puerto Rico part is that, to help you on your way, you can invoke one of four helpers that give you a single special ability for your current turn. And, unlike Puerto Rico, that's only for yourself. The other players don't take advantage of that as well. Once you have stations in all the cities in a region, or pairs of regions for some of the smaller ones, you get points. However, the points scored for a region will drop with each player who scores. So the player that scores first in a particular region might get 6 points, the next player to score there 5, and so on. There are only 3 possible scoring values for most of the regions, so in that case the 4th player would get nothing, and the early bird gets the worm. There's also a mechanism that gives you points for building longer and longer routes. These are represented by carriages. Once you build a route of 3 cities, you can get a 3 carriage. A route of 4, a 4 carriage, and so on up to 7. But you must have built the previous carriage in the sequence to get one. So you can't skip from the 3 carriage to the 5 carriage, even though your route might have 5 cities in it. In that case, you'd still only get the 4 carriage. The reason this is important is that A, the carriages are, of course, worth points, and B, once someone builds the 7 carriage, the remaining players in the round get one last turn, and then the game is over. So you have to take this into account as well. Now, I've skipped over a number of rules here, but hopefully that will give you the sense of it. Suffice to say that all of this leads to some interesting choices. Try to build longer routes to get points that way, or use short routes to get the points from the regions. And if the latter, do you try to fill one region as fast as possible, or try to get coverage over all regions? And with all of this, you have to be careful that you are able to add to your route. If this is not possible, then you have to discard the whole thing. I wasn't sure about the game after the first play, especially since I mistook a connection and had to dump all my cards, because I couldn't add to the route, and then was scrambling just to get points at the end. Something similar happened in the second play, but as I said, I decided to pick up the game anyway. Something about it grabbed me. And as I was explaining it to my drunken compatriots Saturday night, I think it kind of clicked in my head. I like the way that it sets up a min-max game of trying to maximize your coverage without making your routes so long that you run into trouble by not being able to play a card, or you're making them so long that you're not making progress in other areas as well. Also, do you want to waste a turn trying to get more coverage on the board when you could be scoring right away? I look forward to spending more time figuring this out. And it doesn't take that long to play, which is a big bonus given my limited playing time these days. While I was at the Rio Grande booth, I got to try another Spiel des Jahres contender, Seerauber, or as Rio Grande has named it, Buccaneer. And if you listened to the Geekfu Action Grip Origins Report, you might have heard me talking about it while Murr came wandering around. In this Stefan Dora game, you have a collection of poker chips with different numbers on them, representing pirates. On your turn, you nab a pirate or stack of pirates from another player by taking one of your stacks or pirates and placing it on top. If one of the stacks you possess is high enough, then you can choose to raid one of 3 ships that are represented by cards on the table and take the treasure and gold on board. The catch is that you must pay the other pirates in the stack first, equal to their numeric value. That divvies out the gold, and the treasure is handled by giving one to the pirate on top, which is presumably yours, and if there's a second treasure on the ship, that goes to the second player in the stack. After that, all the pirates are dispersed back to their original players. And as the 3 ships get taken, you deal out 3 more and play that for 5 rounds, so 15 ships. In the end, the treasure is converted into gold, and the pirates with the most gold win. I thought the mechanics on this game were interesting, but it's pretty light. There are a number of tactical decisions going on, depending on the other player's moves, but ultimately it comes down to making sure that you get your high-scoring pirates in big stacks, and trying to keep your other player's high-scoring pirates out of stacks that you want to take. While I enjoy the game I played, I'm not sure that the game would last with my group. I also don't see it getting the Spiel des Jahres. But the mechanic is different enough, you never can tell. Before playing Buccaneer, I did get a brief overview of Aqua Romana, which is another game in line for the Spiel des Jahres. It looked like a derivative of Leni Eins and Metro, where you have little tiles with tracks on them, and you try to connect them up to build a system. In this case, instead of building railroads, you're building up aqueducts. The wrinkle in Aqua Romana is that there are these pieces that go around the board which control where you can actually build on your routes. as opposed to being able to build anywhere. While it's not entirely fair to judge a game without playing it, I have to say it really didn't hold much interest for me. And I can't see it holding much interest for the Spiel des Jahres judges either.
Hello, this is Rainer Knizia. You're listening to The Vintage Gamer. And by the way, I've been bullied into this, but the lady next to me is just too beautiful, so I couldn't say no. Enjoy.
The last Rio Grande release I looked at was Funny Friends, designed by Marcel André Casola Merkel and Friedemann Friese. It was originally published in Germany by Friese's company 2F as Fiese Freunde Fette Fetten, which sounds like the beginning of a Def Leppard song, but translates as Mean Friends, Hot Parties. On the surface, this is a relationships life game, like, well, the game of life or careers. But at its core, it's really an auction and resource slash card management game. The idea is that you play a person just entering puberty. You have 9 characteristics, like sickness, alcohol, cigarettes, grief, religion, drugs, etc., which are all initially set to 0. You also keep track of friends, spouses, and sexual partners, some of which can be other players in the game. You are given 5 hidden goals with specific requirements on them that you need to meet, including requirements that cover your relationships with other people. So, for example, sex, drugs, and rock and roll requires that you have at least 1 sexual encounter, 1 point in drugs, 1 point in drinking, 1 point in cigarettes, and 4 friends. Once you meet the requirements for a goal, you can place it in front of you as part of your turn. There's also 1 mega goal that is available for everyone, and the goal of the game is to fulfill the requirements for 5 goals. And at that point, that player wins, and the game is over. In the first stage of the game, you set your characteristics through puberty cards, which can be played directly. But in later stages, you switch to life cards, which have to be auctioned off. The currency for auctions is time tokens, which you get by passing for the remainder of the current stage. The earlier you pass, the more tokens you get. So, for example, if you were playing a 4-player game and you pass first before anybody else, you would get 6 time tokens. The next person would get 4, next 2, and down to 0 for the last person. So, there's the dynamic of the game. Pass early in a stage to get time tokens that you can spend in the next one, assuming that the cards meet your goals. Or try to stick around in a stage and maybe get a chance to cherry pick from the cards that are left, once everyone else has passed. As a side note, the strategy that I used in my first game was that I passed second and third all the time. Now, this wasn't exactly what I had in mind, it just kind of happened that way. This turned out to be not a very good strategy at all. You don't get any of the cards you want, and you don't get any time, especially if you blow it just to pick up the card you need to stay in the game. The person who was dominating the game passed a lot in the earlier rounds, so she had a lot of time tokens to spend, and so she pretty much just controlled all of the auctions. One thing I haven't gone into much detail about is where the friendship part comes in. The game's name is Funny Friends, after all. A big part of the game is establishing relationships with other players and NPCs, friends, lovers, partners, and spouses. Experiences you have and goals you meet can influence your friends. So sometimes you want to establish a friendship, or a marriage, or have a baby with someone, just to ride on their coattails and use their cards to change your scores. Of course, they can do the same to you, or they might make changes that you don't like. For example, you might have a card that requires that you don't have a baby, and all of a sudden they play a card that gives you a baby. Well, there's not much you can do about that. By the way, if your group can't handle 2 players becoming sexual partners, especially between people of the same sex, even in the context of a game, you might want to give this a miss. Our group's pretty laid back about the whole thing, but I'm just throwing it out there as a warning. The game is rated 17 and up, and that's not for difficulty. It's tough to say where this game falls on the weight scale. The theme is very light and funny. Well, if you think unexpected pregnancy, drug use, and bungee jumping is funny. However, I can see the gameplay being a bit of a brain burner with experienced players, with players bidding tough on cards and stingily managing their time. And, of course, making friendships just to jump on someone else's bandwagon, which is, I guess, just like real life. Like Turn and Taxis, I see this getting a fair bit of play in the next few months, just for the theme. After that, I'm not sure. In the long run, there are probably other auction games I'd rather play first, like Amun-Re or Power Grid, for example. But for now, Funny Friends should provide a good diversion. Speaking of Amun-Re, I'll briefly discuss the fourth Spiel des Jahres contender at Zod Origins, which is Blue Moon City, designed by Rainer Knizia. I only got a brief impression of it because I wandered over to the Fantasy Flight booth while the demoer was in mid-spiel, and then because I noticed that he had a giant muffin in his hand and was clearly desperate for food, I wandered away a bit to let him finish eating and came back when he was done. So the presentation that I got was rather disjointed. But from what I gathered from that, and from poking around online a little bit, the goal of the game is to rebuild the fallen city of Blue Moon. The city is represented by 21 tiles, which start out initially with one side showing ruins, and the other side showing the restored building. As the players rebuild sections of the city, they win crystals. Once the city is rebuilt, the game is over and the player with the most crystals wins. To rebuild sections, you play cards similar to the cards from the Blue Moon card game, and in addition to rebuilding, they also allow you to use some special abilities, again, like Blue Moon. Each tile also has some special qualities. Some give you dragon scales that you can trade in for crystals, for example. And this is kind of like Amun-Re a little bit, where each space has a different quality to it. Oh, and of course the three dragons make an appearance, as with the card game. The time I spent with it, you know, all of 5 minutes or whatever, really isn't enough to make a fair impression. But hey, why should that stop me? To make it short, the game did intrigue me. I think it has enough going on to make a gamer happy, but it doesn't look so dense that there's a large ramp-up time. So I think it does have Spiel des Jahres potential. And who knows, maybe this will finally be Rainer Knizia's year. At the very least, I will be keeping an eye out for this one at my remaining friendly local gaming stores. As I understand, it has just gone cardboard. I can talk with a little more authority about the Curse of the Dark Pharaoh expansion to Arkham Horror, which I've had a chance to play twice. Once at Origins with Paul Tevis and the sublime Merlafferty, and once at home, also with the sublime Merlafferty and the not as sublime but still really cool Jason Adams and Rin Nasser. It's a collection of new Mythos, Ally, Spell, and Encounter cards, with a few additional Bad and Good modifier cards, similar to the Blessings and Retainers. There's also a new Artifacts deck that has some awesome stuff in it, which you can get through Encounters and, I think, Spells. I'm not sure, but I think that's right. The idea is that there is a new exhibit in town at the museum, which is causing some additional eel effects to occur through Arkham, as if things weren't bad enough. Now, that first time we tried the expansion, early on the game we drew three Mythos cards in a row that increased the Doom track by two each, or six total. This was due to those cards being placed together in the unshuffled deck, and not getting shuffled thoroughly. Despite this awful experience, for which I blame Paul entirely, I shuffled the deck too, which resulted in Cthulhu eventually devouring us all, I think this is a nice expansion to the game. It adds more variety, and after nearly dozens of plays, seriously, variety was desperately needed. The new encounters also add new flavor, making it feel like there's more going on in the town than before. And while I'm not sure it addresses the issues that detractors of Arkham Horror have, the game's often too easy to win, the strategy's always the same, it's just too random, etc., etc., etc. It offers a lot to the fans of the game. So, if you like Arkham Horror, definitely pick it up. It's worth it. It is an Origins tradition for my wife to pick up the latest cheap-ass game, and this year was no exception. The game this time is Enemy Chocolatier, as usual designed by James Ernest. In this one, you play one of 2 to 6 apprentices to a Willy Wonka lookalike, and your objective is to start up your own chocolate factory. You do this by taking your meager salary and buying up houses in the local neighborhood, which can then be converted into different kinds of factories, like sugar, chocolate, nuts, and love. Love is a component of all good candy, as Burt Bacharach made clear. If you buy up a block of similarly colored houses, then you get certain bonuses, like special abilities, or extra income per turn, or stars per turn. I'll talk about the stars in just a little bit. If you don't buy a house in a turn, you can request a rain check, which you can then cash in later to buy one extra house in your turn. Normally, you're restricted to two. The goal of the game is to either get 20 stars, see, I told you I'd mention it later, or have your factories match a hidden formula given to you at the beginning of the game. So you might have something that says 7 nuts, 3 chocolate, 5 sugar, and 2 love. Now, money is a very important part of the game. We played this one at game night last week, and I was doing much better than the other players, at least on the surface, because I went for extra income right away, as Hunter, the amazing demo guy, showed us at Origins. And then, after that, I tried 4 stars and some of the special abilities. However, I ignored my formula to concentrate on trying to get stars. So, what happened was another player was able to win because she completed her formula first. I wasn't actually too upset about that because otherwise I would have felt it was a little too easy for me to win. I picked up a neighborhood that was generating 3 stars per turn and I was chunking out stars quickly. I think next time we need to be meaner. It is possible to buy out other people's houses for $6, which could screw up other people's plans and make the game a lot tougher. So yeah, in that case, someone should have bought into one of my neighborhoods and stopped me from getting those stars all the time. I think Eurogamers might like this cheap-ass offering much better than some of their others, because other than the goal draw, and to some extent the board layout, there's no randomness to the game. There is that underlying take-that aspect, which might turn some people off, but the $6 cost makes it prohibitive to do so, except when absolutely necessary. Personally, I'm not sure how I feel about the game yet. I think it has some interesting potential, but I'm worried about someone running away with the game like I nearly did. While as a whole the other players should have stopped me, it's not clear that it's in an individual player's interest to do so, as they might just give the win to somebody else instead. To be fair, I was more familiar with the game than most of the other players, and for the price, I'm willing to give it a few more plays.
Follow the Path, the Bear's Grove podcast. Adult-level discussion of role-playing as a storytelling art at bearsgrove.com.
Moving on to Z-Man Games, I unfortunately didn't have a lot of time to spend at their booth, so I didn't get to try any of their new games or even their version of Geschenkt, which honestly I forgot about. But we did pick up their latest B-movie game, Scurvy Musketeers of the Spanish Main, based on Tom Vassell's recommendation. If you're not familiar with the series, they are Take That games, where you're trying to put together a movie complete with characters, props, and a location. And everyone else is trying to stop you by playing creatures that attack your movie. If the creature's attack rating is greater than your total defense rating, including all of your props, characters, and location, then the player who slapped it down gets to kill one of your characters. This can be modified by special effects cards, which give bonuses to the attacker or defender. And really, that's all there is to it. It's a really light, fun game. Now, obviously, if you don't like Take That games and the build-up, tear-down mentality that goes with it, I wouldn't recommend it, as a large part of the game is destroying other people's movies. However, a large part of the fun is taking the cards that are given to you and building a story around it. For example, our friend Jason had a character card with 2 buddies on it, and clearly they were played by Owen Wilson and Ben Stiller. It's a comedy picture. And when his crow's nest with the lusty wench got knocked into the water, well, it's all part of the movie. Beyond that, there's not much to the game. It's just a fun way to pass time. But because all the decks are compatible, we might pick up at least one more of the other ones, like the 70s Blaxploitation deck, and shuffle them together just to see what hilarity ensues. One game I played at Origins, which I didn't end up getting, but I think is probably worth mentioning, is Ticket to Ride Märklin. This is the version of Ticket to Ride which takes place in Germany and features the passenger system. If you're not familiar with Ticket to Ride, Paul Tevis has a great podcast on that and his show. But in brief, you're given a stack of train cars and cards with two cities on them, so your objective is to try to build a route from one city to the other. You do this by playing locomotive cards. Between some cities, you need more locomotives to lay down a route, and other cities, you need fewer. And there's competition over who gets to take over the route between two cities, because some cities only have one path between them. Once the path is taken, it's gone. In this game, there's the addition of passengers, where you have a few, I think three passenger tokens that you can place when you lay down a route. And on cities, there are points that are placed, basically things that you can pick up. And the points go from high to low, so as someone picks up the point value gets lower and lower and lower. And on your turn, instead of doing some of the other actions you normally would do, you can move a passenger along your routes and along some of your opponent's routes. To move along your opponent's routes, you have to play a new special card, which is a passenger card. And you go along, you move the passengers and pick up points. I have to confess that I played Ticket to Ride, I think, 2 years ago at Origins, and I wasn't terribly impressed. I'm not sure really what it was. I suspect it's because we were playing three-player, and with three-player you lose some of the double connections between cities. It might be because the other player waxed us so badly. But again, I just didn't understand what everybody was raving about. This time around, I think I get it a little bit more. I actually like the passenger aspect of the game. I think it added a little bit more to it. Part of my problem is that when I play a rail game, I think I'm pretty much going to sit down and play a rail game. I'm not looking for a light game. I'm going to play something like Eurorails, for example, where I'm planning to put an investment of time in there. And kind of like moving little commodities around, too. I can't say that Ticket to Ride Merklin has convinced me to pick up the game, but I'm at least willing to give it another chance. The remainder of the games I looked at or bought is much lighter in quality, because we were also looking for games that we could play with our 3-year-old daughter. So Omer and I spent a lot of time at the Out of the Box booth. The first game I played there I actually got roped into, and it's a new light bridge variant called Abridged. The idea of the game is to create a version of Bridge with simplified bidding and scoring rules. In this, the standard deck of cards has been replaced with a deck of four colors instead of suits, and each color has numbers from 2 to 14, the 14 here replacing the ace. Sounds kind of like a rook deck. On the 11 to 14 cards, i.e. the jack through ace, dots have been placed to indicate their relative value. So the 11 has one dot, the 12 two dots, etc. I'm assuming that you all have some notion of bridge or other trick-taking games, and if not, well, follow along as best you can, or go back and listen to episode 1, which covered Rook. To judge the value of your hand, you just add up all the dots. Then there's a series of structured bidding rounds where you use this value to decide who gets to be the high bidder and name trump. While this is less esoteric than the bridge bidding, it still escaped me a little bit, but I think maybe a few more plays would have helped. After that, it's classic partnership auction bridge, where the winning bidder's partner lays down her hand as a dummy, and then that partnership tries to take a certain number of tricks, and the other side tries to prevent them. In our case, I did a terrible job of managing the dummy, and we lost badly. But after that, you score, and off you go to the next hand. I think a bridge does have some potential. If we were a big trick-taking card game playing fast-shooting group, I might have picked it up, but we're not. And I've played bridge in the past, enough to get myself in trouble with both the bidding and the play, clearly. So in the end, I think I'd rather just play bridge itself. I've already got the deck of cards. Based on that, I have to conclude the game really isn't directed towards me. I think perhaps a hearts or spades player who really wants to get a sense of what bridge is about would enjoy it better. From there, I got a demo of the game I stopped by the booth to check out, which is an older out-of-the-box game called Fish Eat Fish, again designed by Reiner Knizia. Based on the cute stacking fish pieces, I thought it might be appropriate for my 3-year-old, but after a few minutes of play, I realized while the pieces might be a good fit, the game really isn't. It's a stacking and sliding abstract akin to Focus, with a hand of cards that are used to resolve the attacks. So each player gets a certain number of fish pieces, and these are laid out in a board, which is basically a grid. And any remaining spaces are filled up by purple pieces, which are neutral. Now, the aforementioned cards, most of them have a number from 1 to 5 on them. When you attack another player with a stack of fish, each player puts a card face down and then reveals them simultaneously. The card value is added to the number of fish in that player's stack, and the highest number wins. The winning fish are then stacked on top of the losing fish. There are also octopus cards, which nullify an attack, so nothing happens, and sharks, which always win, except against the octopus. It looked to be a pretty good game, with very fun components. If you think of the graphic of the big fish eating the smaller fish, that's kind of what it looks like as they're all stacked up. But it really wasn't what I was looking for. When I told the demoer what age range I was shopping for, she led me to Blink, which is a fast-paced card-matching game. This, again, is an older game in their catalog, and I thought about picking it up in the past, but hadn't gotten around to it. This one really is a great fit for my daughter. Well, played at slow speed, that is. The game comes with a set of cards with various symbols on them, with different colors and numbers on each card. It's a two-player game, and each player gets half the deck. The top two cards, one from each half, are dealt out face up, and then each player takes three cards into their hand. Then, as fast as you can, you try to lay down cards that match the two topmost cards on the table, and then you can draw back up to three in your hand. A card matches another one if they have the same symbol, color, or number. It's a fun game to play, even with adults, and it's fast. They imply that you can play it in less than 30 seconds, which I think is crazy, but I guess it's possible. We're certainly not playing it that fast with my daughter. For now, she's playing it solo. Eventually, we'll get to the point where we split the cards up and take turns, and then maybe we'll get to the fast version after that. Walla Moppy is a relatively newer game for Out of the Box, which my wife demoed while I was playing Fish Eat Fish. While we didn't get it at Origins, we did end up picking it up at a discount from one of our friendly local gaming stores, which, as a side note, is unfortunately going out of business. Like many of the other out-of-the-box games, this is a fast-paced game where the timer is a marble that rolls through ramps built into the very attractive wooden box. The remainder of the pieces are thick wooden discs that you stack into a triangle, and then players alternate removing pieces from the triangle and stacking them into a tower on top. If the tower falls or the marble drops on your turn, then you lose. I don't see dragging this one out for game night very often, as well, A, it's a two-player game, and B, it's extremely light. But my daughter likes it a lot. We haven't gotten to the point of playing with the timer yet, but still, it's a lot of fun. And the components are fantastic. But then again, I'm a sucker for a wooden box. Just ask my wife about Carcassonne, the city sometime. At the same sale, we did pick up Beatles, which neither of us saw at Origins, but is a relatively new game that was being pushed by Mayfair. It was originally published by Da Vinci. All the players are playing Beatles, and your objective is to try and get your lunch from around the refrigerator. Apparently, the home that you are living in is owned by a very sloppy rock band. It's a fast-paced tile-matching game where everyone is simultaneously turning over tiles in a pile, trying to find the ones that match the characteristics they have on a goal card. If someone turns over a tile with a light on it, then all players must try to find the refrigerator tile as fast as possible or get caught. Beyond that, we haven't really played the game in that much detail, but it looks like it could be fun with my daughter, but maybe when she's a little older. I don't think the fast-paced memory thing is going to work out too well. Then, who knows, it might. And that's it. Hopefully, that will hold those of you who wanted reviews of newer games. Next time, we're back to the older games, and one at a time. Due to the length of this show and the fact that I didn't get much feedback on the Ace of Aces show, I'm going to skip feedback this week. However, if you have feedback for the Vintage Gamer on this show or any other, you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com. Or you can contact me via Skype. My username is JV Square, and you can leave voicemail there as well. Or you can try my not quite so shiny and kind of lonely voicemail number at 1-206-350-8684. That's 1-206-350-VNTG. Feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another whirlwind episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will return to the realm of older games, and one older game. Until then, keep trying those new games. As you can see, I do. But don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.